This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And President Obama told the world today that at the G20 summit dinner last night on Syria, he wasn't sitting all by himself.
It is my view, and a view that was shared by a number of people in the room, that given Security Council paralysis on this issue, if we are serious about upholding a ban on chemical weapons use, then an international response is required, and that will not come through Security Council action.
More about the president and the St. Petersburg summit in a moment, but we're all about listening on this program, listening for a consensus here in the U.S. on possible intervention in Syria. Some public radio talk show hosts around the country will tell us what they are hearing later this hour. And just how does the NSA do some of its most sophisticated listening? If you think they have a problem getting past any of your passwords, think again. The password today is Snowden once again. Scott Shane of the New York Times will be with us. All that this hour, but we begin with the conclusion of the G20 summit in St. Petersburg, Russia.
We may not solve the whole problem, but this particular problem of using chemical weapons on children, this one we might have an impact on, and that's worth acting on. That's important to us.
Kimberly Martin has been listening closely to the public statements and private divisions between President Obama and Russian leader Putin. She joins us now. Martin is a professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Welcome back.
Thank you, John. Delighted to be here.
So what did we see at this summit? Russian leader Vladimir Putin as global gadfly or puppeteer? He'd probably prefer puppeteer.
I think several things are going on. The first is that any chance that he can have to blacken the U.S.'s eye, he's going to take it. But the second thing is that there are a lot of complex issues involving Russian-European relations that are taking place on, that maybe the U.S. press hasn't given a lot of attention to, but that are very important for Russia.
Does Syria and these huge headlines, Snowden, et cetera, overshadow that, complicate that, or is that going on in the background?
Well, we don't see a whole lot of European support for what the U.S. wants to do, and so I think it's sort of not all that much involved in what Russia and Europe are trying to do. Russia's trying to create a visa-free regime with Europe, which would really increase business opportunities, and the Russian Atomic Energy Agency is trying to work out a deal with Rolls-Royce for civil nuclear developments throughout Europe.
And so Europe's interest in that, in the middle of a sort of stagnant economic situation, and the G20 is supposed to be all about economics,
yes,
may be driving Europe closer to Vladimir Putin and keeping the European leaders sort of away from Syria for the time being.
I think that might be part of it. And something to keep in mind, too, is that in domestic Russian politics, the really big event is going to happen on Sunday with the Russian mayoral vote that's happening in Moscow. And Putin may be trying to deflect attention from the Navalny competition that his party is facing in Moscow by trying to concentrate on the U.S.-Russian problems.
So him getting attention, standing up to President Obama, aids his candidate in the mayoral election.
Exactly. It makes him look strong at home, and it makes him look like, you know, if you want Moscow to have favored relations with the Russian government in the future, vote for our candidate so that the network stays in place.
Well, it's not exactly your expertise, but I would suspect with all that going on, President Obama is feeling a little bit like an asterisk at this G20 summit, although he has his own reasons for talking with world leaders.
Oh, yes. I mean, he's been doing a lot of things on the sidelines, too, talking with the Japanese and the Chinese and so forth. But I think, you know, we don't really know what the outcome is going to be on Syria yet, and nobody is talking about carrying out a strike immediately. And I think there's still time for consensus to be built, and we'll see what happens as further evidence gets released.
And as we'll talk later this hour, the things in Congress aren't looking so well for the president on that score. Let's talk a little bit about an issue that probably would have been right at the top of the agenda but for the Snowden issue and the Syria question, and that is the question of gays in Russia and the looming Olympics and the controversy there. The president will be having a meeting with the folks in Russia who are opposed to this new law on homosexuality.
Yes. What's interesting is that Putin was very clever because he bought off some of the people that Obama had wanted to meet with. There's one group in particular led by somebody named Lev Ponomaryov that Obama had wanted to meet with, a major human rights organization that had been a victim of the NGO law that Russia passed earlier this year. And Putin turned around a couple days ago and said, oh, we're sorry, we made a mistake. We'll offer you a new building that's owned by the Kremlin. And amazingly, Ponomaryov now doesn't want to talk to Obama.
So wheeling and dealing, even on this issue here, how much is at stake for these Winter Olympics coming up?
I don't think it's going to have that much ultimate impact on the Olympics. But I think the biggest thing that we're seeing is a push by the international community to try to target the economic interests that are involved and not just the political interests.
Take us inside the domestic politics on this gay issue in Russia, if we can. Let's get away from the G20 summit for a moment. What is really driving this in Russia, this question of a law which makes it a crime to influence young people with evidence of a gay lifestyle because it might turn them into something, on the order of a social malaise of one kind or another? Is that a fair characterization of this law?
Yes. And Putin has a very strong relationship with the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. So that's certainly part of Putin's network that he's trying to pay off by taking this very conservative stance. But as many people have pointed out, Russia does not really have a conservative social culture on many issues. This is just one thing that's not particularly controversial among the Russian population that Putin can score points on.
So it's big with the church. Russians aren't going to stand up one way or another. And so it's really for the international community to push. It's just not an issue inside Russia.
Yes, and on economic interests in particular.
Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Always fascinating to talk with you.
Always a pleasure, John.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
All this week, we've been putting your questions about Syria to your lawmakers. And today we turn to coastal North Carolina, where 3rd District Republican Walter Jones says this Syria question has lit up his constituents.
We're getting calls by the day, by the hour, and it's running almost 10-1 in opposition to bombing Syria.
You know, that is consistent with what some of your Democratic colleagues have suggested. They're getting very, very negative constituent calls on this. What do you think is the issue? Is this a weariness from the situation in Iraq, or is this something very specific to this attack, to this president, and to this country?
John, I really believe it's that the American people are tired of war, but also we have learned from the Iraq war and learning from Afghanistan that no nation in the past history of the world has ever changed the Middle East. And if Assad did use gas to kill the people and the children, then why doesn't another country take the lead instead of America? You and I both know we're what's called a debtor nation. In other words, we cannot pay our own bills. We have to go to the international market to finance our debt. How can we spend tens of millions of dollars to fire missiles into Syria? Let's not always be the policeman of the world.
Now, is your position and your passion on this informed at all by the experience in 2003? You were very much a supporter of George W. Bush on the Iraq invasion, yes?
I did vote to give the president the authority with the hopes that he would not, this is where I was very naive, not go into Iraq. I did not understand at the time that they had manipulated the intelligence to justify the war in Iraq. I've become very, very dubious of any administration when it comes to the foreign policy, and that foreign policy means that we're going to attack another nation.
Skepticism from Congressman Walter Jones, Republican from the 3rd District of North Carolina. We got a comment from someone in Charlotte yesterday that I want to play for you that really is a pretty nuanced view of all of this, and I suspect you have a response. Here, listen.
This is Doug McWilliam from Charlotte, North Carolina. What about the boots on the ground in Turkey with the missile systems? What about the boots on the ground in Jordan, training the Jordan army? If a war breaks out, aren't they at risk, and aren't they, in fact, boots on the ground already?
Congressman, what do you think of that idea? We already have boots on the ground in the region all over the place.
Well, I want him to know that, yes, he is correct. And I made the statement a couple of months ago that if any young American is sent to a country over in the Middle East without the Congress voting yes or no, we need to send troops over there, then I would introduce articles of impeachment. The Bush administration manipulated the intelligence to go into Iraq. What do we get from Iraq? 4,400 Americans killed and over 100,000 Iraqis killed. And now the country is falling apart. We need to learn what Ronald Reagan learned, John. When he was the president and 241 Marines were killed in the barracks in Lebanon, and he pulled the Marines out afterwards because he said, we do not understand the Middle East, and we're not going to change the Middle East.
No, and indeed, President Clinton pulled our troops out of Somalia after the Black Hawk Down incident. So, you know, there's bipartisan impulses there that you're referring to. You know, your passion really reminds me of just how worked up you were over the old Freedom Fries issue back when France wasn't supporting the U.S. in 2003. Now they're taking the lead on this one. How do you feel about that?
I would let the French take the lead, and let's sit back and watch them do the work. I regret that I did, but it was a constituent who asked me to write the letter to change the name from French Fries to Freedom Fries. But I can honestly tell you that I'm dubious of any administration, Republican or Democrat, that says that we have high expectability that they are using the weapons of gas and other type of weapons. And, John, there have been soldiers and Marines holding placards in front of their faces saying that we're not going to go defend our enemy, Al-Qaeda. And they are there working with the rebels.
Secretary Kerry yesterday suggested that the number of jihadists, the Al-Qaeda-affiliated folks within the Syrian opposition, is no more than 25%. The majority are not bad guys, he said. Are you buying that or not?
No, I'm not. If it's 1%, then that's too many. I don't know why we continue to want to back groups that we do not understand their mission and their anti-American feelings until they take power, and then we know they don't like us. This is a stupid foreign policy.
Finally, Congressman, I'm really appreciative of your candor here. There's really been for you in Washington a journey of conscience, and you're feeling much less party affiliated today and much more feeling matters of principle.
Well, John, I made this decision when I was too weak to vote my conscience. My conscience said, do not give President Bush the authority to go into Iraq. And I was more concerned about getting reelected, which I should not have been. It should have been, as you said, all about principle.
So we don't get fooled again. That's the lesson.
Absolutely, John.
Congressman Walter Jones, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Congressman Jones represents the 3rd District of North Carolina.
This is Keith McInnes. I'm in Gainesville, Florida. I disagree that our credibility is going to be harmed. We back off and create an international coalition of the willing and move with that coalition. Does anyone think that Iran or North Korea are going to be emboldened because we didn't spank Assad with a few missiles?
My name is Besma. I'm calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm Syrian. I am with the military intervention in Syria because someone needs to stop this bloodshed. If no one do anything, this crazy person is going to keep on killing the children and the civilians in Syria.
Two thoughtful comments there from both of you, Rossmann and Keith. Thanks so much. They're certainly not the only two thoughtful comments. Go to thetakeaway.org. You can see on facebook.com/thetakeaway all of the opinions and views, really all over the map, split views and a real debate going on the question of intervention in Syria. You can also give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and directly join the conversation. More of your questions on Syria answered. We go deep into the hearings this week before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Stay with us.
You want answers?
Of course you do. And here at the end of an important week, we want to take you deep into the hearings in the House and Senate and get so many of you with questions some real answers.
This is Dave from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And my question for the president today would be, if we do a targeted strike in Syria, isn't that a provocation of war, a declaration of war on the country of Syria?
That was one of the frequent questions asked of Secretary of State John Kerry and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel. What might happen if Syria retaliated against the United States for a U.S. military strike? Hagel replied that U.S. forces were ready for anything, And Secretary Kerry said any such retaliation would be a, quote, miscalculation by the Assad regime.
If Assad is arrogant enough, and I would say foolish enough, to retaliate to the consequences of his own criminal activity, the United States and our allies have ample ways to make him regret that decision without going to war.
There's a key question from Chris Lindsay on Facebook. What if a limited military action is not enough? Is President Obama ready to commit to putting boots on the ground? Repeatedly, administration officials said no this week.
Bottom line is, the president has no intention and will not, and we do not want to, put American troops on the ground to fight this or be involved in the fighting of this civil war, period.
You want answers?
This is Susan from Parkland, Florida. No, we are not the moral compass of the world. People are dying in horrible ways all over the world every day, unfortunately. I believe our intervention would only invite Assad and the Arab world to make us their number one enemy. I believe the UN needs to take action, not the United States. Did we not learn anything from Iraq?
Hey, this is Justin from VIA. I just wanted to understand why there are so many comparisons to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Now, there's a distinction between this and Iraq. In Iraq, intelligence purported to suggest that weapons of mass destruction existed, but we didn't know if they existed. And so we had a massive invasion in order to try to find out if they existed, and we found out they didn't. Here we have weapons of mass destruction that we not only know do exist, they have been used not once, not twice, not three times, but multiple times. We estimate in the teens, and the opposition estimates more than that.
There was considerable frustration from so many of you that international institutions like the United Nations were being bypassed by the administration in the Syria matter. Susan Budak-Run asked, why can't we intervene but not militarily? Is there enough proof to bring Assad to a war criminal court? Which is exactly what Republican Representative Ted Smith of New Jersey wanted to know on Wednesday.
I plan on introducing a resolution when we reconvene to authorize the president to establish a specialized court, the Syrian War Crimes Tribunal, to help hold accountable all those on either side, including Assad, who have slaughtered and raped in Syria. I wonder how you might think about that as well, whether or not the administration would support such a court.
Secretary Kerry, surprisingly, did not reject this idea, but he did make an important point about Congress and its tolerance for international courts.
I understand there have been conversations already with Syrians and other countries about a special court. Perhaps we can have more luck with that. I would certainly welcome an effort to hold people accountable for those kinds of abuses. But as you know, the international courts have not fared well with both parties.
Because of congressional votes, Kerry is saying the U.S. is not a signatory to the treaty that created the International Criminal Court, or ICC, in The Hague.
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
Some of the exchanges this week between Texas Congressman Ted Poe and the witnesses were particularly illuminating. For instance, listen here how skeptical Joint Chiefs Chairman Dempsey seems to be about the U.S. getting involved with the Syrian opposition, echoing the concerns of many of you.
General Dempsey, you mentioned earlier that you are concerned about removing Assad from power. Do you want to? Will you elaborate on that?
Well, I still, again, separate from this conversation, which is about the limited purpose of deterring and degrading, I still am cautious about whether we should use U.S. military force in support of the opposition for the purpose of tipping the balance. I think there's other ways we can contribute to that through the development of a moderate opposition. But I remain cautious about taking the opposition's role here in the civil war.
Many lawmakers went way beyond cautious and called the opposition al-Qaeda-infiltrated jihadists. One of you in Provo, Utah posted, the rebels have bona fide Islamic terrorists in their midst and Islamic fascist tendencies in their mentality.
Patricia Murphy, San Antonio, Texas. The people on Capitol Hill need to start looking forward on who's going to take over Syria when they get rid of Assad.
Another great question from so many of you. Can this contemplated military strike significantly change the civil war in Syria? And if so, then what?
The goal of U.S. policy is not a stalemate. The goal is a negotiated solution which results in the departure of Assad and the free choice of the Syrian people for their future.
which suggests the U.S. may have a long-term role in some future negotiations. And as for long-term roles for the U.S. in Syria, Tom Dorm from Gualala, California, north of San Francisco, opened this can of worms. Consider the possibility of eliminating, destroying Syria's chemical weapons. Seems to me that just punishing the guy will not eliminate the further threat of his use of his nasty weapons. I don't know what the options might be. And on that one, General Dempsey had a very curious and slightly chilling answer this week.
We do have, at the classified level, contingency plans with regional partners to secure a finite, a limited number of sites. The challenge we have with that is the number of potential sites. And the regime has a tendency to move their chemical weapons around. We think to secure them, but at some point it may not be to secure them. And so I would just tell you that we do have contingency plans with regional partners for the security of the weapons, but it's a very heavy lift.
He seems to be saying there's already planning for a U.S. role in some large-scale future cleanup operation in Syria.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
Keep your questions about Syria coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE, thetakeaway.org, and facebook.com/thetakeaway. First Friday of the month, time for a jobs report. The Bureau of Labor Statistics' August report seems to contain some back-to-school numbers here. Employers added 169,000 jobs in the month of August. There's a revision for July. The unemployment rate falls to 7.3%. Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC, joins me now. Positive, but
not so good.
Not so much.
Not so good. I mean, the number of jobs created was a little bit below what people had expected, so people weren't too happy to see that there were only 169,000 jobs created. The estimate was around 180,000, so a little off there. And while this unemployment rate number has come down, which seems like a good thing, and that it's down now to 7.3%. The analysis of it is that this is mostly because people have stopped looking for work, or they are not actively looking for work for whatever the reason. Because again, to be considered unemployed, you have to actually be looking for work. So if you retire, if you say, I can't find a job, I'm just going to stop looking.
It's the discouraged workers.
The discouraged, right, whatever it is, that's a big reason for this decline in the unemployment. And that's not the reason why you want to see the unemployment rate going down.
And, you know, it's these two trends that we've really been talking about now for about the last 6 months, where there's the structural changes in the economy that lowers the labor force participation and creates this discouraged worker class that you're talking about. That's really a kind of a healing of the wounds, or a continuation of the wounds of the 2008 meltdown. But then we do have growth.
We do have growth, and
the Fed's going to be looking at that.
And we do have jobs that are being created, but it's not necessarily at the pace that we really need to see to replace this other problem. The first thing that you outlined, the losses that we saw after the financial crisis. So as a result, we're seeing some steady – these are okay numbers, but they're not great. You really want to get them higher. There was one estimate I saw this morning that we would need to have about 300,000 jobs each month for the next 4 years to really replace the jobs that were lost since the financial crisis. And the other thing I'd point out here is, you know, as we're going through changes, what we don't know is how much of this drop-off is also just related to there are more baby boomers who are retiring,
right,
or maybe
demographics.
You know, a lot of issues of older people who have lost jobs and can't find new ones. Perhaps they're not returning to the workforce.
A lot of structural factors here, and Ben Bernanke talks about that when he's testified recently. I guess it's coming down to the last few times he's going to be testifying before Congress. But is that 300,000 jobs number really the trigger for the Federal Reserve to stop this interest rate stimulus that they've been doing, or are these numbers an encouragement for them to start to back off?
It's hard to know. I mean, you would look at these numbers and think, wow, unemployment and employment is not doing so well, so maybe the Federal Reserve holds off on ending some of these programs. They're going to be meeting later this month, and we could actually hear if they're starting to do this, what everyone calls the tapering effect. And it's interesting, you know, watching the analysis this morning, a lot of journalists seem to think this is going to be the Fed saying, well, maybe we'll hold off on the taper for a little bit. But a lot of economists are saying, we think it'll still happen. We think that this month we may start seeing the Federal Reserve start to slow down these programs that they have and stop, you know, buying all these bonds, buying all these assets to try and keep the economy going. It really, people are just kind of guessing right now. You would think, though, that with everything that's going on with the debate over Syria, which is really pushing out any sort of conversation mm-hmm. in Washington about the debt ceiling, how much money we can borrow, about funding the government, about cuts.
Obamacare coming in
October 1st. All these things that are out there, there could be, you know, what we don't know is how much does the Federal Reserve look at all that and say, you know what, we don't need to stir this pot up as well. Because don't forget, the president also has to choose his next chairman of the Federal Reserve, and that could be a contentious argument.
Are you a betting man? You betting man? You going Yellen or Summers?
Everything seems to point to Larry Summers.
Is that right?
But, you know, what'll be hard to know is if Obama tries to push through a vote on Syria to then turn around and say, okay, now you got to take my Federal Reserve chairman choice, they may say no.
We shall see.
We'll see.
The politics of everything. Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC. Thanks so much.
You bet.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
No more. Hang on.
I'm trying to use the phone.
Forget Spartacus. It's Movie Friday here at The Takeaway with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, along with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hi, John.
So it's all about Riddick, right? That's the big blockbuster this weekend, sort of the last real weekend of the summer, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
All right. Let's listen, first of all, to Vin Diesel coming back in this franchise.
Grant any last wishes? I was referring to you.
Not that the chains aren't a hot look, but no. Not in front of all these guys.
What if I killed all of them first?
Sultry superheroes. So what do you think, Rafer?
You know, I was not really that familiar with this whole franchise, which started with Pitch Black about a decade ago.
Which people liked.
Chronicles of Riddick, the second one, not quite much. But I really got a kick out of this movie. You have to put up with a lot of nonsense, including dialogue such as we just heard. But I think once it kicks in and gets going, it really taps into its inner 13-year-old boy and just runs with it. I think it's pretty well made, some great effects. I really enjoyed it.
High intensity, macho.
It's well made pulp.
Kristen's got to love this one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. It was awful. And I think part of the problem might be I don't have an inner 13-year-old boy in me. I don't have that in me. The first half of the movie, I just have to explain here. Riddick is trapped on a foreign planet that's very hostile. There are creatures that want to kill him. And the first half of the movie, he's just by himself trying to survive with all these CGI characters. And it's like a really, really, really bad CGI version of Castaway. And then the second half of the movie, he is...
Castaway, though. That's interesting.
He's fighting these bounty hunters. And the bounty hunter fighting second half of the movie is like every awful horror movie you've ever seen, only a lot worse. I did not enjoy any of this movie. And Rafer, I'm so shocked that you liked this. This was terrible.
Vin Diesel, though, any Hugh Jackman did you detect Diesel?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. No Oscars for Vin Diesel.
No
I'm sorry.
Oscars for Vin Diesel.
He'll take the money.
So, Riddick, yeah, definitely. All right. So, Kristen, I suspect you probably were a little more enthusiastic about the J.D. Salinger biopic.
Absolutely.
All right. Listen.
The works that no one's seen. I do know he's been working all these years because probably the second time I'd ever been allowed in his study, he very proudly showed me a set of files where a red dot meant this is ready to go upon my death. A green dot meant this needs editing.
A lot of reveals there. J.D. Salinger's daughter, Margaret, talking about how, you know, maybe she had a slightly troubled relationship with her dad, but also about these new manuscripts that are actually going to be published.
Yeah. So this documentary delves into the big secret. What was J.D. Salinger doing during all of those years when he was in seclusion in New Hampshire in his cabin? He was hugely popular after Catcher in the Rye, and then he just pretty much disappeared off the face of the earth. And we see what he's been doing. And I don't want to be a spoiler here, but we learn every single thing that had the red dot and the green dot that she just referred to. Which books after he dies are ready for publication, what the titles of those books are, the summaries of those books. And I'd say for Salinger fans, the big reveal is going to be totally worth it. But if you're not a Salinger fan, and even if you are, you might find some of this documentary a little sloppy, a little choppy. Sometimes it feels more like a fan movie than an actual investigation. So it's got its flaws, but it's worth it for the big reveal, I'd say.
All right. So finally, in theaters now, but on its way to popular culture, The Ultimate Life.
The 12 gifts that your grandfather taught you, any idea where they came from?
No.
Well, you're about to find out. He kept the journal from the time he was 15. Maybe you can find something from his past to help you here in the present.
Schmaltz, directly for you.
Oh, so schmaltzy. And you know I love schmaltz. This is a movie directed by Michael Landon Jr. It's inspirational. It's kind of a Steps for Highly Successful People sort of movie. And this is also going to be released directly to the Hallmark Channel later this year. And I'd say wait for the Hallmark Channel. Just sit on the couch and watch it with some popcorn.
How did I miss this one?
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. They are the Movie Date Podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John. You too.
The Edward Snowden leaks on matters of secrecy, domestic surveillance, and the operations of the National Security Agency have become something of an archive of U.S. electronic spy technology and capability. The NSA, according to the latest revelations from the Snowden archive, considers the encryption technology that protects all of our identities and bank accounts online to be something of an enemy. According to our partner, the New York Times, the NSA seems to have bypassed or simply cracked much of the digital encryption in the world, building powerful supercomputers, the sole purpose of which is to break through encryption codes on the front end of cyberspace while compelling tech firms to insert back doors into their systems and software for the NSA to enter at will. Scott Shane joins us now, national security reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Scott, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, is that an exaggeration? Enter at will, back doors, front doors, supercomputers?
Well, you know, we have a limited view of this from, as you call it, the Snowden archive. We, the New York Times, were given somewhere around 50,000 documents by The Guardian. The collection mostly deals with the British counterpart of NSA, GCHQ, but there are thousands and thousands of NSA documents as well. And the British agency and the American agency work very closely on these things. I think, you know, Snowden himself, interestingly, in an online chat with The Guardian, said that strong encryption was still a fairly good defense against an agency like NSA. But he also said that NSA was very good at snatching communications from one end or the other. Even ordinary email like Gmail or Yahoo Mail now have routine encryption that you or I don't bother, don't even know about. But it's automatically implemented when you send an email to somebody. But they're very good at snatching the message before it's encrypted on the front end or after it's encrypted on the back. So sometimes the agency doesn't need to crack the encryption in the middle, so to speak.
Now, is there any legal issue here regarding encryption? Is encryption any sort of defense that you need any special warrant to bypass, or is it purely a technological matter?
As far as we can tell, there's no implication here that NSA has broken any laws. There is a sort of public policy issue in the background here. In the 90s, as encryption began to be widely available, there was kind of panic at NSA over the idea that soon everything would be encrypted and they would be stuck. They'd be kind of locked out of everybody's communications. So they, along with the FBI and other agencies, proposed something called the Clipper chip. And this was going to be a chip that was installed in all hardware and there'd be a software solution. Essentially, it'd be the government's backdoor into everybody's communications. There was a big public debate about this in the civil liberties and technology community. And NSA and the government lost, and Congress didn't like the idea. Very wide a coalition of folks on the right and the left, technology companies, civil libertarians, nobody liked it. So the government backed off. And what we found in our reporting looking at these documents is that NSA, right after that, the Clipper chip was dead by the end of the 90s, and by about 2000, NSA began a very expensive, very aggressive campaign to find many different ways to do the same thing, essentially to get into everybody's communications, but not in an open way as part of a policy like the Clipper chip, but in a stealthy way.
It stretches the definition of backed off. It seems more like the government didn't back off, just worked around what Congress said.
Yeah, I think that would be fair to say.
Is there any international agreement in the business world of online encryption that gives certain players greater access than others? Or is the NSA so far out ahead of any attempt to regulate here?
We don't know how far the NSA is ahead of other countries. Undoubtedly, countries like China and Russia, their intelligence services are trying to do the same thing. The one interesting aspect of this internationally, though, is that as encryption has come on as a technology, obviously companies, governments, individuals are interested in, how do I know that this encryption product works? And so there have been there are international and national standard-setting bodies that say, that sort of certify, this is an international standard in encryption. You can trust this if you use this on your communications. And it turns out that NSA has used its influence actually to weaken the standards, according to these documents. And there's long been a suspicion that they have taken that role, but these documents do confirm that they essentially want to make sure that even if no one else can read somebody's encrypted conversation, they can.
Talking with Scott Shane, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. So every time I set my password and the little notice says moderate, weak, strong, very strong, there really should be an asterisk, which should say strong except for the NSA.
That does seem to be the implicit policy of NSA. You know, they have a dual function in the government. They're supposed to intercept foreign communications and collect electronic intelligence, eavesdropping. But the other half of the house is to protect American communications. First of all, government communications, you know, that when the president makes a call, he calls on a special phone that is, you know, and NSA's job is to make sure that thing is secure. But also they advise businesses, certainly defense contractors and folks like that who are doing government business. But beyond that, there's sort of the sort of brain trust for encryption in general. And so half of their job is protecting U.S. communications. Some of the cryptographers we talked to, some of the independent experts in this area, when we told them what these documents showed, they felt that there's an argument that NSA has sort of overreached here and that by building backdoors and weakening the encryption that's now used by everybody on the internet, including Americans and American companies, they may in fact be undermining the security of American communications.
Amazing. Scott Shane, national security reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week has been all about a debate and a conversation. The president invited a national debate over U.S. intervention in Syria, and that debate in Congress, which may culminate next week in up or down votes in the Senate and the House, has become a national conversation about the U.S. role in the world, about the brutal, frustrating history of the Middle East, and who has the power to order the Pentagon onto the battlefield. Joining me now is Ben Philpott, who hosts Agenda Texas for KUT in Austin. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
The great Craig Folly hosts the Craig Folly Show on WDET in Detroit. Nice to talk to you, Craig.
Nice to talk to you as well, John.
And Ben Allen is a reporter for KOSU Radio in Oklahoma City. Hey, Ben, welcome to the show.
Hey, John.
So to all three of you, you've been hearing this conversation, right? Mix it up. What have you been hearing, Craig?
Two words, John. Cynicism and doubt. There are people that just fundamentally do not think that the United States has the ability to make a difference militarily in this conflict. That is coming through loud and clear with the calls that I've got here.
Cynicism and doubt, Ben Philpott?
You know, we've seen a little bit of that doubt in some of the lawmakers that I've talked with, some of our congressmen. Specifically, you know, we've had Ted Cruz, our Senator talk about the U.S. is not needing to be Al-Qaeda's air force. Congressman McCall, also here from Central Texas, is concerned as well that there are not moderates to help if the United States were to go in and take some military action.
Well, a lot of the Texas delegation is making a big play in this story, Ben Philpott. I mean, Ted Poe from, I guess, the Houston area. He was very prominently featured at the hearings along with Congressman McCall. Ted Cruz, again, calling this attack Al-Qaeda's Air Force. Are you serious?
Yeah. You know, and it plays in with the idea that is, you know, floating around that there are no moderates or there are not enough moderates in these rebel forces. And McCall, Congressman McCall, actually yesterday when I talked to him said, you know, look, we're talking about arming rebels. I then asked Secretary Kerry, can you promise me that these arms are not going to fall into the hands of Hezbollah? He said, well, no, we can't promise that. So he then said, well, then we're going to end up arming Hezbollah.
Well, you've done your work with the Texas delegation. Here's Congressman Lloyd Doggett, who you spoke with. He's a Democrat from the 35th Congressional District. Listen.
It has been almost unanimous in rejecting the notion of our going it alone in a civil war in Syria, even if the intent is to have limited military involvement. I expect as this debate unfolds and we see more and more information from the administration that may change somewhat.
So I'm hearing there in Lloyd Doggett, who's a congressman from the 35th Congressional District of Texas, I'm hearing bipartisan skepticism from Texas. Craig Foley, is it on the Republican and Democratic side, skepticism and cynicism?
Well, you know, there are certain congresspeople on the Democratic side that are going to fall in line behind the president. Congressman Sander Levin certainly did, suggesting that there is a moral responsibility of the United States to ensure that chemical weapons are not used. And if that means a military strike against Bashar al-Assad, he's likely going to vote in favor. But on the other side, you know, Gary Peters, is also a Democrat. He has yet to take a position on this, saying he's going to wait until he sees some of the classified intelligence before he makes up his mind one way or the other. Now, keep in mind, he is running for Senate in Michigan next year, so that may play into how he decides to approach this at this point.
Well, the consensus on Capitol Hill is that the president has a real problem running the numbers here, but we'll know more about that next week. On the Craig Foley Show, listeners get a vote. Here's one.
My opinion on this stuff is that we have a United Nations to handle these things, and that's where it should be left. The United States is squandering our money in all these weird little wars. In my lifetime, that's all I've seen is war, war, war.
Listener named Garrett on the Craig Foley Show talking about all the weird wars he's witnessed. Now, that's WDET in Detroit. Ben Allen, I suspect the folks in Oklahoma City may be more supportive. What are you hearing there?
No, not at all, John. As a matter of fact, they are much more skeptical, really. And all five Oklahoma representatives, five Republican representatives represent the state of Oklahoma. All five of them say, without even seeing that intelligence or anything like that, they're skeptical. And some have even come out and said they outright will not approve. They will vote no for congressional authorization of a military strike in Syria. And that is kind of bucking the trend a little bit in this state, because this is a very strong military state, five large military bases here, including Fort Sill in Lawton. And it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you follow the trend of this state. Now, on the other hand, some people are saying, you know what, we've done enough of this. We have been the world's police officer for far too long. And you know what? Maybe it's time for us to just sit this one out. And you're hearing that from people on the far right as well as people on the far left.
And it's hard to gauge the partisanship here. Craig Foley, is there a tension between supporting Obama in your part of the world, in the Detroit area, and the question of national security that's raised by this whole Syria intervention?
Oh, absolutely there is. And in fact, you know, it seems that, you know, you talked about that isolationist streak. We were just hearing that from Ben just a second ago. That seems to be pretty strong here. There are a lot of people looking at problems in cities like Detroit and suggesting that if we've got the money to expend on a war that may not have any sort of defined endpoint. Yet we can't keep cities like Detroit from going under. There's a lot of cynicism there as to what are the priorities of the United States. And so you're starting to see a lot of people saying, you know what, President Obama, we voted for you twice, but we're not going to be behind you on this one.
And it plays definitely into the economic numbers, even though the unemployment rate is down. The labor force participation is low, discouraged workers, more people not working, pretty much out of the workforce. Ben Philpott, some final thoughts?
Well, I think in Texas, as we were hearing from Oklahoma, people are just war weary. You know, we also have played a large, at least people feel we've played a large part in the recent wars with a lot of our military bases. And yeah, they're tired.
And the president may lose this one, eh, Ben?
Well, you know, I mean, when one of the more liberal congressmen in Texas who says he wants to support the president says that the president still has a lot of heavy lifting to do to maybe get his vote, then I think, yeah, he's in trouble.
And he's over at the G20 summit doing that heavy lifting at this point in the week. Ben Philpott hosts Agenda Texas for KUT in Austin. Craig Folly hosts the Craig Folly Show on WDET in Detroit. Ben Allen, take us out from KOSU in Oklahoma City.
Well, I would just say that one of the things that's really unique about Oklahoma, just for one second here, is that this is a state where Christianity is big. And a lot of people have said to me they're concerned about what happens if the U.S. gets involved or doesn't get involved and it falls into extremist hands. What does that mean for Christianity in that corner of the world?
The Middle East always sort of a kind of biblical theater there for people in the Christian community. Ben Allen, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Thanks to all three of our public radio hosts gauging the national debate on Syria. We're also hearing from you on whether the U.S. should intervene.
My name is Saba from Newark, New Jersey. At first, I was against President Obama taking strikes into consideration, but after seeing these horrible videos with these dying or dead children because of the chemical strike, I'm definitely all for it, 100%.
My name is Greg from Petaluma, California. I am totally opposed to any kind of military intervention, especially unilateral military intervention in Syria. If we have learned anything over the course of the past 30 years, 40 years, that bombs are not the answer.
Thanks for listening, especially all you folks in the state of Georgia. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.